This is After Deadline. I'm your host, Steve Forrester. Writers are not always good talkers, but my guests today are excellent conversationalists. Brian Doyle is editor of Portland Magazine, the award-winning publication of the University of Portland. Brian is the author of Mink River, The Grail, and other books. Bob Pyle's first big book was Wintergreen, Rambles in a Ravaged Land. Bob resides in Grays River, across the river from Astoria. It's an event when these two are in town, as they are on the day of this recording, for an event called A River of Words. It's a benefit for Rain Magazine. Well, welcome, Bob. Welcome, Brian. Good to have you here, both.
Thank you, Steve. Good to
be
here.
Thank you, Stephen.
We're going to talk about what these two writers are working on. I've also brought something for each of them to read and discuss, and I've asked them to bring something of their own to read. Brian Doyle, you edit Portland Magazine with four issues a year, and you write books and articles. How far ahead do you plan Portland Magazine?
We try to plan out a year in advance, just almost as a compass point, kind of a lodestar. But quite often, by the time the magazine actually is born, it's a third of what it was dreamed to be. But you have to have dreams, it seems to me. Dreams are like magnets for magazines.
So I just got your last issue, a month or two ago? And that would have been the spring issue?
Yeah, we try to come out the week before the season begins, if at all possible, just for sheer entertainment's sake.
What can you tell us, anything big you've got planned out in the future that's coming in the next magazine?
Actually, we just did our last winter. We did a big campaign issue. University's in a big fundraising campaign, and they gave me carte blanche for the first time, and I made a huge, epic halibut of an issue, like 88 pages. It was enormous, with photographs to die for. And this year, they sort of gave me the same wink. And so I'm going to actually make a music issue of the magazine with a CD in it. We're going to collect music from all over the university community, all over the world, and make a CD to make people's eyebrows singe. It'll be great.
Well, I will tell our listeners, on radio you can't show people things, but Portland Magazine is a very pretty magazine. Beautiful magazine.
Sure, it's lovely.
Who designs it? Who's your designer?
There's a designer in Portland, Joe Ursig, who's wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of a tall, thin guy, so we have a tall, thin magazine.
He's a bit of a legend in Portland.
He's a testy genius.
Yeah.
That's probably the best way to say it.
Yeah. Well, aside from Portland Magazine, what are you working on?
I just had a novel come out a few months ago, which is a ball. I mean, I'm still doing readings and talks, and kids are reading it at school, and I'm still getting piles of letters.
And it's called?
Mink River, novel set on the Oregon coast.
Yeah.
A very Oregon novel. I really wanted to write a novel about Oregon-ness in a funny way.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a book of short stories coming out in the fall called Bin Laden's Bald Spot and Other Stories.
Uh-huh. And you had an article, somewhat controversial, I guess. I liked it, but I guess some people didn't, in the Oregonian, about Bin Laden's, how he wasted his life.
Oh, a total waste of gifts. I mean, by all accounts, a charismatic man, a man of enormous intellect, a man rich as sin, and he completely punted his gifts, I thought. I got a slew of angry response from people who were annoyed that I had said that Catholicism already tried
because you brought
military,
up the
you
brought up the Crusades.
Right, I thought the Crusades were an epic act of Catholic terrorism, personally, but I got a lot of angry letters. In fact, I got so many that I won a bottle of wine from a friend of mine who bet I would get fewer than 20 Dear Idiot letters. But I got more than 20, of course, so I win.
Well, what did the faculty at the University of Portland say?
Thank God they're not here. They're all in summer tenure. I'm sure I'd get a few Dear Idiot letters, but I thought I was right, actually.
Yeah, well, I think you were, too. Bob Pyle, you lecture, you do residencies at various colleges, and you usually got a book in the works. Where have you been lately? That's always an apt point to ask with you. And what's in your literary cooker?
Actually, Tia and I just returned from China a couple of days ago. I was lucky to be 17 days in the nature reserves of China, all the way from east of Beijing to the eastern edges of Tibet. And for 5 days in the Foping National Nature Reserve, a UNESCO site where we did see a wild panda, as well as a wild flying squirrel that is red and black and white and so big that it looks like a Volkswagen door plummeting through the canopy. It was an extraordinary time, some of the best days of my life. And I'm leaving in another week for Australia for 3 weeks. So have been getting about just a little bit.
The China trip, how did that come about?
A dear friend of mine in Boulder, Colorado, Janet Chu, her late husband was a member of the Chinese Air Force at the end of World War II, later came to this country. And so she had a long-time connection with China, as well as with Chenault and the Flying Tigers and so on and so forth. There's been reunions over there. But she's a naturalist. She's a fellow butterfly traveler. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And she put together a small trip for a group of friends. And as a freelance writer, it's nothing I ever could have afforded. But was Tia and I were able to do it in exchange for helping with the interpretation and the wildlife finding on the trip.
This is After Deadline. The voice you just heard is Bob Pyle of Grays River. Our other guest is Brian Doyle of Portland Magazine. And so, Bob, next, Australia. What are the circumstances of that trip?
It's a job, Steve. I'm going to give writing workshops in Byron Bay and Tasmania and to take part in a writing conference that's held annually at a place called Camden Haven in New South Wales. John Daniel, another one of our dear Oregon friends and writers, was the guest last year. Each year they bring one Yank. Maybe it'll be Brian Doyle next year. And I'm also going to be giving a reading at the National Library of Australia in Canberra. So that'll be an honor.
What do you have in the way, what do you have in the works book-wise?
Well, as you know, my last book was Mariposa Road, a big book of travels around the country looking for butterflies and everything else that I could find. I was on tour for that all last fall. Astoria was wonderfully kind and warm and receptive about it, as was your newspaper. I've been working, Steve, you might recall my saying more than once, for a long, long time on a novel. Brian beat me to it. He got his novel published first, Mink River, which is, by the way, one of my favorite novels I've read in years. My novel is called Magdalena Mountain. It's going into its 10th draft. I've got a publisher interested who's actually published a piece of it before, so I'm hoping that he might go for it. I almost went with Houghton Mifflin last time, but not quite. And then recently I submitted a book of poems. I've been writing a lot more poetry lately, which is the hardest thing I've ever tried to do.
Yeah. You travel, it seems to me, a lot. What percentage of the year are you in Grays River?
I'd like to be there almost all the time, but as I've been freelance for more than a quarter of a century, which means that I've got to come up with a way of paying the bills every single month. And so consequently, it all depends on the opportunities, and I almost never travel unless it pays some bills as well as provides a good natural history experience. Try to put the two together. I'd say it varies year by year, but normally I'm home about half the time, maybe two-thirds if I'm lucky.
When we come back from a break, Brian Doyle and Bob Pyle will read some selections that I've brought for them. This is After Deadline. I'm Steve Forrester, and I'm back with writers Brian Doyle and Bob Pyle. By prearrangement, I've brought a selection for each of my two guests to read. Brian's will be a recent work, and Bob's is a theater classic. I'm doing this as a way to hear some things that are very interesting and have you hear them as well, share them with you, and also as a way to have a little conversation with these two guys. Brian, I've asked you to read a poem by Sherman Alexie. It ran in The New Yorker of May 16th, and it's a poem called The Facebook Sonata, if you please.
Welcome to the endless high school reunion. Welcome to past friends and lovers, however kind or cruel. Let's undervalue and unmend the present. Why can't we pretend every stage of life is the same? Let's exhibit, resume, and extend childhood. Let's all play the games that occupy the young. Let fame and shame intertwine. Let one's search for God become public domain. Let church.com become our church. Let's sign up, sign in, and confess here at the altar of loneliness. Sherman Alexie.
Yeah. Striking work.
He's a very interesting guy, Sherman Alexie, kind of a pan-talented fellow as far as I can tell. He's great at the short story. He's written novels, novellas. His essays are very good when I've read them. And his poems always have kind of a dart to the heart in them.
So is that a comment on the emptiness of the Facebook culture, or what is it?
It seems to me, yes, he's kind of riffing on the very thing that makes Facebook fun. It also makes it sort of empty a little bit, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah.
There's a sort of cheerful shallowness to it that I think Sherman threw the dart and hit it.
The notion of you can have a virtual life.
Yeah,
a virtual life.
You can pretend to be somebody online that you're not really.
Yeah.
I mean, we do that all the time anyway in life. I mean, writers do that with their fiction, certainly. They create personas, and many of them are aspects of yourself, perhaps. But
yeah.
Well, I love Sherman because he's always been a great and generous advocate of my book, Where Bigfoot Walks, which was a concern of mine that Native Americans would appreciate that book, which has a lot of Indian.
He is Native American.
Indian lore. He's in Native American. He's from the Spokane tribe or nation, and some of his books are set, tragic and funny books set in the Spokane and Nez Perce area. Sherman also gave one of the great one-liners that I ever heard. He was the MC for the Washington Book Awards one year, Governor's Book Awards as they were then, and Governor Mike Lowry wanted to present Sherman with a certificate of appreciation, and he backed off of the stage, and Sherman said, "I don't know, Mike, the last time an Indian took a piece of paper from a governor in this state, it didn't work out too well."
But Well, I wanted to, in the course of our conversation today, bring up Sasquatch, because you wrote a book about Sasquatch, and this is as good a time as any since you've come to it through Alexi. There's been a sighting more recently near Spokane, an alleged sighting, I gather. What do you make of that? Is that real or not?
Well, I received a telephone call from an NPR affiliate in Spokane and consented to an interview on that. And of course, what I had to say was that I haven't seen the images. They're on a telephone. People take pictures on telephones now. And I have no idea whether it's going to have any credibility or not. What I did want to convey in my interview is that one should maintain an open mind, which was, of course, the point of my book, that scientific approach to the world, which I tried to bring to Bigfoot, not to find it or prove it, but to say this is a very, very powerful element of Northwest tradition and culture, whether it walks in flesh or blood or not. And we would be foolish probably to dismiss it out of hand without careful consideration. So I simply said, let's keep an open mind till we see these pictures.
My wife and I were at Lake Quinault Lodge and sort of did the drive around the lake with the guide, and Sasquatch inevitably came up, and because this fellow had known a ranger who had, as he put it, seen something he couldn't explain. And I asked the question of how do the Quinaults explain Sasquatch? How do they talk about him? And he said that, if I can remember this correctly, that they view this as someone from another time dimension who has briefly entered our time dimension.
That's one Native American view. There are many. The majority of the Native Americans I've spoken to up and on the coast and who still live in the mountains and the woods and not in the cities have a literal belief in the animal as they do in skunk and weasel and beaver and mink, and not as they do in Tsimshian, the sea serpent, or the thunderbird. Some see time travel, some see interdimensional, or some see a spiritual entity here. But the majority of Indians I've talked to think it's another kind of human being with wild traits. They almost all accept it as a reality, however. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that my own experiences at the end of the book and then a couple since over the past 20 years in the same place have given me perceptions that I have no other way of explaining either.
Okay. Well, Bob, let's move to the selection I gave you. It's a personal favorite of mine from Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. Charlie is one of the Lohman family's friends. And it's in the scene called Requiem, sort of the third act, I guess, of Death of a Salesman. And Willie's dead, and they're burying him. And this is Charlie's speech at the cemetery.
"Nobody dast blame this man. You don't understand. Willie was a salesman. And for a salesman, there is no rock bottom to the life. He don't put a bolt to a nut. He don't tell you the law or give you medicine. He's a man way out there in the blue, riding on a smile and a shoeshine. And when they start not smiling back, well, that's an earthquake. And then you get yourself a couple of spots on your hat, and you're finished. Nobody dast blame this man. A salesman has got to dream. It comes with the territory."
So many wonderful lines in that.
There are. It's a wonderful play.
Smile and a shoeshine.
Yeah. And it's an earthquake, yeah.
Long time since I've seen the play, and you make me want to do it again.
Yeah. Well, you indicated in a response to me that you have more than a passing response to this.
I do. I'm so happy you made the selection for me to read, Steve, because my father was a salesman. He knew about the spot in the hat and the keeping the tie straight, and he knew when it was all over, too, and I don't think he ever quite hit that point. But this line speaks volumes to me, because I agree, and nobody dast blame this man.
Yeah.
Salesman does what he does.
Yeah. The first Willie Loman was Lee J. Cobb. And in the days before before a lot of things, they made a recording of that play. It's around, of course. It's probably on CD by now. And it's a powerful. Mildred Dunnock was Linda. And I think Arthur Kennedy was one of the sons. And Lou Grizzard was the other son. I may have that wrong. But it's a powerful production. And then, of course, there's the Dustin Hoffman version. And,
right.
And I don't know who all else has done that role. Have you ever seen it, Brian?
I have. I saw one version. I think it was Brian Dennehy was the...
Yes.
Was wonderful in it, too.
Yeah.
That's one of those plays I think you could probably... That'll be played forever, hundreds of years on American stages.
It and West Side Story will be done in 50 years.
Right. And all the works of Tom Stoppard. In order.
Brian, you would like someone named Brian Dennehy.
Yeah.
Nice Irish boy.
Yeah, very, very Irish boy. Big, large Irish boy. That production, we saw, my wife and I saw the Dennehy production, and it opened with his silhouette, you know, holding the salesman's bag and obviously fatigued and so forth. Now, the University of Portland does a lot of drama, does a lot of music. Have they ever mounted Death of a Salesman?
They have done one that I know of. I love their plays. We're actually very good. It's one of the things the university is very good at. And one of the things I love about it is that they almost always have totally stripped down stages and propless productions, because they're very alert to the fact that it all occurs in your imagination. And just a shrug, just a hint, just the instant suspension of disbelief, I think, is just a delicious thing. To watch theater done in front of you, to be created in front of you, ephemerally, in the air, unrecorded, and by two or three young people sitting on a bench, and suddenly, poof, they're in a park in the middle of Iowa. Isn't that cool? There's something glorious about theater made in front of you, I think.
Last summer, my wife and I saw The Tender Land, Aaron Copland's opera, seldom performed. And it was done for NBC as a teleopera, which happened in those days. That's where Menotti's Christmas opera, Amahl and the Night Visitors, comes from. It was done for NBC. And, of course, as always is the case, it was performed and it was too small for the stage because it was done for a TV studio, so he rewrote it and so forth. And it was, we saw it in upstate New York, which was kind of fitting. It was in farm country and all that, but your point about imagination taking over was so true, because we had to imagine that this was the Depression, et cetera, et cetera.
There's such a communal fabric, I think, to live theater. I mean, everybody in the room willingly suspends belief. You know, you all go there together, and a great production just sucks you in. You're all suddenly, you know, on a boat in the middle of the Pacific. Just like that. And 2 hours later, you kind of snap awake thinking, oh, my goodness, I have to drive home.
Well, speaking of Death of a Salesman, did either of you ever hear Arthur Miller interviewed?
I have, actually, yes. When I lived in Connecticut, of course, he wasn't around anymore. But there were people on campus who had, in fact, worked with him in the drama department. And I did hear an interview of his, not firsthand, but I remember it was stunning.
Yeah.
It was a stunning interview.
I was struck. I heard one, and I don't know who did it, that he had a definite urban twang to his voice and so forth. And I think, if I've got this right, it was sort of like, yeah, that's my dad I'm writing about. It was sort of like that.
About the play, Death of the Salesman. Oh, my.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when we come back, Brian and Bob, Brian Doyle and Bob Pyle, will read some selections of their own works in progress. This is After Deadline, and I'm speaking with Bob Pyle, the writer from Gray's River, and Brian Doyle, the editor of Portland Magazine. For this segment, I've asked Brian and Bob to bring something that they're working on. And Brian has brought a fragment from the novel he's writing.
I hate it when writers explain that longer than they read, but the brief context of this is, in my novel there's a scene where an older guy's got 3 days left to go. He's going to die in 3 days. He knows it. It's been ticking for him all through the book. And a young guy says to him, can I ask you a blunt question? What mattered? What mattered in your life? And the older man's answer is, hawks huddled disgruntled against hissing snow, wrens in winter thickets, swallows carving and swimming and slicing fat grinning summer air, frozen dew outlining every single blade of grass, Salmonberries, blackberries, thimbleberries, raspberries, cloudberries. My children learning to read. The sinuous liquid flow of rivers and minks and cats. Fresh bread with way too much butter. My children's hands when they cut my ancient grizzled face in their hands. Exuberance and ebullience. Tears of sorrow, which are the salt seas of the heart. Sleep in every form from doze to bone weary. The shivering ache of a saxophone and the yearning of an oboe. Folding laundry hot from the dryer. Cobblers and tailors. Spotless kitchen floors. The way horses smell in spring. Postcards in which the sender has written so much that he or she can barely squeeze in a signature. Opera on the radio, toothbrushes, the postman's smile, the green sifting powdery snow of cedar pollen on the porch every year, the way herons labor through the sky with such vast elderly dignity. People who care about hubcaps, the cheerful ears of dogs, all photographs of every sort, tip jars, wine glasses, the way barbers sweep up circles of hair after haircuts, handkerchiefs, libraries, poems read aloud by older poets on the radio. Fedora hats, excellent knives, the very idea of albatrosses. The tiny screws that hold spectacles together, book marginalia done with the lightest possible pencil, as if the reader is whispering to the writer. People who keep dead languages alive, wooden rulers, fresh mown lawns, first baseman's mitts, dish racks. The way my sons smell after their baths. The fact that our species produced Edmund Burke. The orphan caps of long-lost pens, welcome mats, ice cream trucks, bees, cabbages, kings, eulogy, elegy, puppetry, fingernail clippers, the rigging of sailing ships, ironing boards, hoths and scythes, the mysterious clips that girls wear in their hair, trout and grout, peach pies of every size, the sprawling porches of old hotels and the old men who sprawl upon them. The snoring of children, the burble of owls, the sound of my daughter typing her papers for school in the other room, the sound of my sons wrangling and wrestling and howling and yowling, all sounds of whatever tone or tenor issue from my children in all other forms of coupled pain and joy, which is to say everything alive, which is to say all prayers, which is what I just did. Amen.
Great. Great. It was like a benediction.
There's an outburst.
Yeah.
I love reading that in schools because without fail, especially in high schools and grade schools, kids will say, is that an essay or a piece of fiction or a poem or a list of ingredients? Or
what did you just do? Yeah.
And I love that it's the formlessness of it appeals to me greatly. Mm-hmm. You know, that mm-hmm. it shows that forms are only vessels in which to pour your prayer.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
You can see why I love that novel so much. It goes from that kind of flight of wonderful language into things happening really fast and happening dramatically.
Well, Bob Pyle, let's move to the poem that you brought, that you're working on.
I'm actually going to read two. One is extremely short that sort of sets the tenor for the collection that I've recently more or less finished, though, of course, it won't be finished until and if it's published. The collection of poems is called The Evolution of the Genus Iris. And this little poem sort of sets the tone. It's called The Girl with the Cockleburrs in Her Hair. We were talking about how children don't get out anymore. She showed me her daughter on her cell phone. Big pout and four big burrs caught up in her hair. That girl, I said, is going to be okay. This is the longer version. It's called Notes from the Edge of the Known World. And I wrote this in collaboration, really, with a local figure, Chris Novoselic, who's the master of our grange in Grays River, known for other purposes too around her. He, on his radio show on KMUN Radio, DJ Kano, he used to play Walt Whitman together with John Fahey guitar. And I said, Chris, you play some John Fahey stuff and I'll read some Whitman for Grange. And he said, the heck with that, let's do our own piece. So he wrote a wonderful guitar piece. This is the poem I wrote to go with it. And you can find this on YouTube, actually. If you look up Notes from the Edge of the Known World, you can hear Chris's guitar as well. When winter wren and varied thrush break into April voices, and elderberry branches crack and thrust, and Sitka spruce in caws of crow, and wild waves all slap on ocean shore, this small black beetle jaws a crumb, and smaller scarlet mite roves over needled dirt to somewhere we will never see, as sward fern rots upon its ancient mound and fiddleheads unfurl. When sorrel triplets burst upon the guileless scene and moss-hung branches point away through trackless wood where puma sinks its teeth in throat of deer who gives its life unwillingly but has no choice. when somewhere on the other side of time and whirling world beside some withered waterhole, a warthog coughs, and baboon flashes scarlet rump and grimace blue and toothy at the other males, at swollen, gravid female, at lioness who charges, then withdraws, behind the yellow grass. Then polar bears on permafrost and skuas over tundra sedge will take whatever sustenance the day affords, then sleep and sleep and sleep some more despite the midnight sun. As in the forest gloom the lichen hangs and sways above the snailish stream, and mushrooms crowd the mossy bank where hemlocks screen the sunlight from the silage of the slugs and slime of molds and thyme, where water bears and woodlice roam, bacteria and nematodes make way among the great and fleshy entrails of the world. And what about the turquoise-mantled giant clam, cemented in the coral reef beneath Antipodean skies, the urchins dragging spines across the limy bottoms, poking holes in water bags to make the ocean new for every life on every tide? Or clouds that drop their shadows on the desert floor, that parking lot for tortoises, where cactus reaches out for gods it never knew or needed? Flash floods scrape away whatever luck the horned toad ever had, which isn't much, it seems, until you think of otter clamped in orca's gape, or flank of desert oryx running red beneath the claws of leopard, every desiccated leaf and flower folded in upon itself, until you think of ants and worms and voles and frogs in tractor ruts, or salmon smolts in heron's bill, until you think of this great ape, the one that stands upright and poses every question ever asked in such a world where everything that grows breaks down and down and down, then grows and grows and grows and grows again.
All right. Well, Brian's poem I could see, and yours I could smell.
I can hear it, and I can hear the guitar in it.
And feel. Yeah. Well, we have about a minute left in the show, and I want to talk a little bit about how you do your craft. What time of day do you write, Brian? What's your...
Oh, quite early in the morning. I have children, so getting everybody up and out and is actually great for me as a writer. I yell at all my children and get them off to school, and then I have about an hour. But if I can work for an hour a day, I think, as my father says, it's shocking how much muck develops over the course of a year.
So what time of day do you work, Bob?
Not in the morning, Steve. I start the day with Tia's help, gently with coffee and a good book to read in the morning. And then my best times for writing are late in the afternoon or late in the morning, late in the afternoon. And then if I'm on a deadline, way into the night as well.
I had a guest on the show, Carrie Timchuk, who writes books in the company of Gert Boyle and Bob Dole and so forth. Right. He writes 9 to midnight. Hmm. It's a new one on me.
I thought that was a beer hour.
Try to be in front of a glass of wine and a good book at that time if I can.
Deeply shocked. I agree with Bob totally on that one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's great to have you both on this show. And I think we, at some point, Mr. Pyle could devote a whole show to Sasquatch. But
we'll do that sometime. But it's such a pleasure to be here with my dear friend, Brian Doyle, and our great man of the town, Steve Forrester.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, host.
Yeah,
thank
you're
you,
welcome.
Astoria.
Yeah, good to have you here. This has been After Deadline, and my guests have been Brian Doyle of Portland Magazine and Bob Pyle of Grays River.